Welcome to ForensicFilesNow.com, home of the informed recap, your source for updates and epilogues to your favorite episodes of Forensic Files. I'm Rebecca Reisner, author of ForensicFilesNow.com. This week's podcast is Michael Prozamenchikov, A Success Story Dies. It covers the Forensic Files episode, Going for Broke, the story of how a poor Russian immigrant made a fortune, but cheated his friends and paid with his life. This episode is narrated by Vicky Crete.
For a while, Michael Prozamenchikov seemed to be doing everything right. In hopes of a more prosperous life, he came to the U.S. from Soviet-era Russia, where he'd grown up in an apartment crammed with 30 other people. He arrived in Minneapolis and got a job as a janitor for $63 a week. He studied finance and earned a stockbroker's license. Amid the 1980s Wall Street bubble, Prozamenchikov grew into a tiger of a salesman. He nabbed a $240,000 signing bonus when Prudential Beach Securities recruited him as an investment advisor. Within 7 years of coming to America, he was driving a Mercedes, living in a newly constructed 20-room house with his wife and two sons, and making $1 million a year. But as so with many other Forensic Files subjects, his American dream turned into a cautionary tale. Prozamenchikov's story, however, differs a bit from the usual, because he ended up as the homicide victim, not the perpetrator. For this week, ForensicFilesNow.com did some research into Prozamenchikov's background and how he botched the financial fiefdom he created. So let's get going on the recap of Going for Broke, along with the extra information from online research and the book The Prubach Murder, The Fast Life and Grisly Death of a Millionaire Stockbroker by Jeffrey Taylor. At 10:30 p.m. on January 28, 1991, Michael Prozamenchikov called his wife, Ellen, to let her know he was on his way home. He never arrived. Police found his Mercedes with his checkbook, credit cards, and some cash inside in a parking lot in Wayzata. Soon after, a headless torso and two legs from a Caucasian male turned up under some discarded Christmas trees. The severed tip of a left pinky finger and scars on other body parts helped police identify the victim as Michael Prozamenchikov, age 37. So who would want to kill this respectable family man? Well, lots of people, it turned out. Although he labored long hours and aimed high, Prozamenchikov also liked to take shortcuts. It was a pattern that started when he still lived in the USSR. After excelling in hammer throwing as a boy in Leningrad, Prozamenchikov used his athletic connections to get into dental school there. He was a poor performing student, but still managed to network his way into a job as a dentist in Russia. But the U.S. had more strenuous requirements, and Prozamenchikov failed his dental exams here. Fortunately, he landed in a more lucrative field thanks to a friend who encouraged him to try a career in finance. He learned quickly and aggressively pursued clients, many of whom were fellow Russian Jewish immigrants. But Prozamenchikov was in too much of a hurry. Greed overtook him, and he made impossible claims to clients. He engaged in unauthorized trading and falsified information. Like most good con men, he had a knack for putting on an optimistic front, even as things headed south. He persuaded clients to stay with him, despite their losses. Although the police had no specific murder suspects at first, they found that a lot of people didn't feel all that bad to hear about Prozamenchikov's demise. First off, Prozumenchikov had begun to separate himself, literally and figuratively, from the Russian Jewish emigre community that had helped make him successful. He and his wife Ellen and their sons, ages 11 and 13, had moved to Wayzata, a lakeside town with a yacht club and a median house price of $600,000. And he liked to flaunt his Rolex watches and Mont Blanc pens. On his desk, he kept framed photos of cars and houses he aspired to purchase. While the Prozumenchikov sons were attending private schools, their father was busy erasing the personal fortunes of the people who trusted him to help them attain better lives for their own kids. Zina Sherl, who appeared on Forensic Files, said that Prozumenchikov went renegade with $20,000 of her money. Prozumenchikov had also used clients' money to make disastrous investments in Texas Air, which promptly dived 75% in value, and today no longer exists. Even as his clients' accounts were shrinking, Prozumenchikov would make as many as 100 trades on a single account in a year so he could pocket the commissions. He wiped out the $70,000 life savings of a World War II vet named Clem Seifert. Seifert would later enthusiastically volunteer to testify in the killer's defense. Prozumenchikov had also persuaded clients to invest in developing a Reno, Nevada resort that was an utter scam. The project never happened. Clearly, Prozumenchikov's death was somehow related to his job. His wife told police that on the night he disappeared, he had called her to ask for his supervisor's number. Next, he called his boss from a payphone to ask for $200,000 in cash for a client. His boss refused. Then, Michael Prozumenchikov disappeared. Police were able to connect a brown 1986 Mazda 626 seen parked near Prozumenchikov's black Mercedes on the night of the murder to a handsome 30-year-old dam inspector named Zachary Persitz. The Prozumenchikov and Persitz families were close friends. Their little sons had sleepovers together. Persitz, also a member of the local Russian Jewish community, entrusted Prozumenchikov to invest $150,000 for him. A lot was riding on that investment. Although the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources surely paid Persitz a decent salary, his wife, Julia, a concert violinist, had been needling him. Why couldn't he be as successful as his buddy, Michael Prozumenchikov? But Persis wouldn't be buying Julia a McMansion or an E-Class Cabriolet anytime soon. A combination of Prozumenchikov's mismanagement and the 1987 stock crash diminished Persis's wealth by anywhere from $37,000 to $120,000. Fortunately, Persitz left behind a lot of clues when he snuffed out the man who wrecked his finances. Shortly after Prozumenchikov's homicide, a car wash employee had written down the license plate number of the Mazda after noticing the driver trying to wash blood from inside its trunk. He had told the car wash workers he hit a deer. Police discovered that paint found on Persitz's bumper looked similar to that from an orange gate near the crime scene, and bumper fragments found there matched those missing from Persitz's Mazda. The Mazda had blood on the inside. Authorities also learned that an axe that Persitz kept in his locker at work had gone missing, and the Persitz family had a Bernese mountain dog whose hair matched a strand found at the murder scene. Not that the family pet was in on the homicide. Shed fur carries and transfers like crazy. County Prosecutor Kevin Johnson remarked it was, quote, the first time a search warrant has been executed on a dog in Hennepin County, end quote. On February 4, 1991, authorities arrested Persitz and set his bail at $750,000. Prosecutors believed Persitz set up a meeting with Prozumenchikov, then threatened the 6-foot-tall, 200-pound-plus stockbroker with a gun. Persitz demanded $200,000 to cover his losses, plus interest. When Prozumenchikov couldn't produce the cash, Persitz shot him, threw him in the trunk, and then headed to a compost site some 60 miles away the next day. He crashed through a gate there and dismembered the body. Once charged, Persitz didn't take the usual Forensic Files killer route by claiming the victim attacked him first. Instead, Persitz declared himself not guilty by way of insanity. Judge Robert Scheifelbein delayed the trial so the defense team could obtain Persitz's 1970s records from a psychiatric hospital in Russia. Mental health professionals for both the defense and prosecution ultimately agreed that Persitz suffered from OCD and severe depression. In fact, the judge agreed to another delay so Persitz could undergo electroconvulsive therapy. Persitz said that, as a child, he had witnessed violence between his parents and had tried to kill himself at age 11. His claim of suicidal tendencies was credible. While awaiting trial in 1992, Persitz and fellow inmate Russell Lund made a pact to suffocate themselves with plastic bags. Lund succeeded, but deputies reached Persitz in time to save him. The defense argued that the crime itself was crazy enough to prove insanity. Persitz admitted to shooting Prozumentchikov once on the frozen Lake Minnetonka and again in the Mazda, then hacking up the corpse the next day. Quote, "Clearly, chopping a body up in the early morning hours when it's 20 below is nonsensical," end quote, defense attorney Paul Eng offered. Still, prosecutor Kevin Johnson made the state's case that Persitz had been plotting the murder for months and was sane enough to know that killing Prozumentchikov was wrong. The jury convicted Persitz of the murder on June 23, 1993. In a separate hearing, the panel rejected the insanity plea. He received a life sentence with the possibility of parole after 27 and a half years. Widow Ellen Prozumentchikov blamed the murder on Persitz's, quote, "envy and greed," the Tribune Star quoted her as saying. Quote, "Michael was living his American dream. His dream was suddenly ended by someone who couldn't bear to see it realized, who couldn't accept Michael's life in comparison to his own," end quote. With the trial over, Ellen, a dental hygienist, also said she hoped to begin the, quote, "healing process for our family," end quote. Persitz's parole eligibility would have come around in 2021, but he couldn't wait. He hanged himself in Stillwater in 2010. Persitz had admitted that he threw Michael Prozumentchikov's head and hands, the instruments of his deceit, into the St. Croix River. They were never found.
If you'd like to see the links and the images that accompany this post, go to ForensicFilesNow.com and type "Going for Broke" in the search field. Please make sure to follow my blog or subscribe by sending an email to ForensicFilesNow@gmail.com. This podcast was edited by Brian Phelan. Music is courtesy of Joseph McDade. Thank you to Vicki Crete for narrating. Until next time, this is Rebecca Reisner for ForensicFilesNow.com.